All right, welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast. We are sitting here talking with Dexter Upton. Morning, Dexter. How
are
you doing?
Morning, Ryan. How are you?
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm a physical therapist at the Memorial Hermann Bel Air location. I also help to coordinate and run the sports residency program for physical therapy at Memorial Hermann, and also do a lot of teaching, mentoring within both the orthopedic and the sports residency program.
Okay. And what did you talk about today?
I talked about manual therapy techniques, specifically just regarding how to utilize them in the training room or clinic setting.
What patient population did you feel like would be best utilized with the manual therapy techniques in those particular settings?
Oh, yeah. So that's a great question. So research has typically shown that the more acute they are, the better outcomes you're going to get. So the quicker you can get them in and get them manipulated or perform some of those manual techniques, the better their outcome is going to be. So typically the patients that I like to perform it on to see the biggest benefit are going to be those high school, college age athletes, because typically they're the ones that we're seeing that have those acute injuries, right? It also is beneficial in the older population, don't get me wrong, but it typically takes multiple sessions of manual therapy before they start seeing the benefit that you would see from the younger population.
Okay. So both of us being PTs, we have a little bit of a lag time between seeing these patients.
Oh, yeah.
So now trainers who have opportunity to see them immediately, mm-hmm. sideline or the next day at school before they make it out to a PT clinic.
Right.
What injuries are they going to potentially look at or say, hey, you know what, in my toolbox I just gained from my last talk, mm-hmm. what are some techniques, what are some populations that they can look at to say, hey, these would be best, these techniques would be best utilized on these types of populations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so usually where they're going to see the biggest bang for their buck are when they're treating some kind of mechanical dysfunction with the, you know, CT junction, thoracic spine or lumbar spine. Also, a big one is ankle sprains. So athletic trainers see a lot of ankle sprains. They can perform some manual therapy to improve some dorsiflexion, reset that talus back into the center of the dome. They're going to see pretty big outcomes from that immediately. And then hopefully not have them need to be sent off to a physician because they're already feeling better after they perform the techniques.
There seems to be some research, lots of research out there about the benefit of manipulation to, you know, acute ankle sprains,
mm-hmm. yep.
right? Lateral instability and things like that.
Yep.
So let's do the subjective. As a trainer, as a therapist, what are you looking for? What are you listening for to kind of say, okay, this is a potential patient, and then objective, what are you seeing?
Yeah, so good question. So obviously, if you're thinking about performing manual therapy on anyone, you need to make sure that there's no more sinister diagnosis going on. So you want to make sure that you rule out fracture, any sharp, tender spots, specifically on bony protuberances. You're also going to want to make sure that they don't have any gross instabilities. So as you're talking with them, if they're, you know, saying that they can't take a step without their ankle flopping over to the side or something like that, that's going to be someone that kind of raises your concern a little bit and maybe makes you take pause before you provide that manual therapy treatment, right? Objectively, what you're going to see oftentimes is that they've got limited range of motion. It could be painful. It could be they feel a pinch in the joint when you try to take it to their end range. They might have some, you know, neurological responses going on, some numbness, tingling, things like that due to the swelling. So all of those are things that can be improved at least a little bit with some manual therapy to the talocrural joint or, you know, eventually the cuboid if that's also sublux plantarly.
So if it's acute, how is there a too acute phase?
So that's a great question. So in all the research, they actually encourage you to do it as soon as on the sideline of the field. So if it happens at a football game or soccer game, they're wanting you to try to manipulate that TC joint as soon as they get to the sideline because they're seeing benefits from it over letting them rest for a little bit and then perform the manipulation.
Okay. And then you harp big on doing manipulations and then following it up with exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Let's stick with the ankle for a second.
Yep.
Give us some good exercise in the training room, in the clinic, even at home after a game, that some patient or athlete can follow mm-hmm. Those techniques up with.
Yeah, so typically, as I mentioned in my talk, dorsiflexion is going to be the big limiter for a lot of people. So exercises that address dorsiflexion, you can do a kind of a kneeling lunge where you're taking them into dorsiflexion. You can even kind of progress that to different ranges or different angles of the dorsiflexion. Those power resistant bands are really good for providing self-mobilization. So if you take one of those power bands, you anchor it to the leg of a table or into a doorway, and then wrap that around either their distal tibia or around that talus, and then provide those same kind of oscillations into dorsiflexion, you can actually get a really nice mobilization with movement there.
Is there a benefit for active stretching versus passive low-load static stretching?
So, good question. If they're acute, I would probably lean more toward that active stretching, because it also, at the same time, is going to help with kind of milking that swelling out of the joint versus a passive stretch.
Is there time for a passive stretch?
Yeah, when they're not competing and they want to just gain range, but that's, you know, research is very up in the air about that, so...
Let's move up the chain now. We're into, mm-hmm. as you said, CT junction, thoracic spine, those areas.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to see those a lot. So baseball players around here.
Yeah.
We don't have a lot of rowers, but, you know, rowers are commonly having those mid-back thoracic mm-hmm. issues. Let's talk about a baseball player.
Okay? Yeah.
Kid comes in complaining, shoulder blade pain, that gray zone of,
mm-hmm.
Scapular pain, not real sure what it is.
Right.
As a manual therapist, what would kind of be your checklist to kind of go down whenever this person's talking about that?
Yeah, so first thing I'm going to want to look at is, what does their neck and thoracic spine movement look like, and does that exacerbate any of the pain that they have, right? Oftentimes what I'm going to see is that as we start to stress that in-range rotation or side bending, that's when they're going to start complaining of those symptoms a little bit more. Especially if I take them into some accessory movements with the neck or thoracic spine and they get that reproduction of pain, that's pretty much a gold star to say, yes, this is kind of the pain generator, mm-hmm. and I can address this very quickly with some manipulations to that area.
So let's talk thrust or not to thrust.
Yeah. So as I said in my talk, research is kind of all over the place with thrust versus non-thrust. They do it a lot for – the research is pretty heavily weighted to the cervical spine, because a lot of people are anxious when manipulating the cervical spine. So that's where a lot of the research is. But if you look at one research study, it'll say that, you know, a thrust manipulation provides, you know, that extra little benefit versus a non-thrust manipulation or mobilization. And then you look at another research study that says, well, they're about the same. And in my mind, if you have research studies that are kind of not necessarily conflicting, but saying, oh, you know, half the time the thrust manipulation is better than the non-thrust, and then the other half, well, they're about equal, then I'm probably going to hedge my bets on the thrust manipulation. One, it's a little bit quicker to perform, and I don't have to spend much more time with the patient than is needed, and I'm trying to be as efficient as possible because I've got multiple patients or multiple athletes in the clinic. So in general, I'm going to kind of favor the thrust manipulation. I also think when we talk about the placebo effect and the, you know, providing that neurophysiological reset, oftentimes we need a little bit more of a quick stretch to those structures versus a slow, you know, maintained stretch to those joints, whereas that quick stretch is going to be provided by the thrust manipulation, it won't be provided by the non-thrust manipulation. So that's another reason why I'm going to try the thrust manipulation, and then you add in that placebo effect of getting a cavitation or a pop. That just adds another little piece of the pie for the patient or athlete to say, ooh, man, something just happened. I must have gotten better.
Yeah, so going back to that high school thrower with the back pain,
mm-hmm.
They're real hesitant to let you crack them. they benefit from more of the slower manipulation, mobilization, and then kind of once they've kind of gained some trust, then allow you to go to the next step? Would you progress them if they're benefiting just with the slow and still want to go to the thrust, or is that something that you just kind of...
Absolutely. So we see this all the time, especially when we talk about CT junction, because, again, a lot of athletes are a little bit nervous about, you know, getting their neck popped or cracked or whatever verbiage they use to say it. So in those cases, I'm going to start with the non-thrust manipulation or mobilization. And as they progress and feel a little bit more comfortable, if they are still having symptoms, then I'm going to try that thrust manipulation. Even if it's session two, session three, and we're seeing benefit, but my job is to try to get them better as quick as I can. So I'm going to do all that I can to try to do that.
So you have these ankle sprains, you have these neck pains, shoulder pains come into your clinic or your training room. What are some red flags right off the bat you should say, this is not a candidate?
Oh, yeah. So anyone that has any, like, gross instability complaints, if they've got any hard neurosigns, so myotomal changes, you know, God forbid they're having bowel or bladder issues, anything like that. Those are things that are going to kind of raise a red flag. Also, if their pain is severe, if they go to that end range and they're jumping off the table as you touch their neck, maybe they just have some yellow flags of kind of being behaviorally a little bit kind of off or more fear avoidant than your typical patient or athlete. That might be someone that I'm going to take a step back, kind of reanalyze the situation and see, does this person really need it, or can I just do some general exercises to make them better?
So if you have somebody who's totally against manipulation, or you just don't feel like they're going to be, we'll say, calm enough to allow you to do it, but they trust, but you want to do it and they would benefit from it, do you have some good ideas or exercises that are, like you mentioned, like self-mobs type stuff, things that they can do at home, besides the fact that if you do it in the clinic and you still want them to carry it over at home? What are some ideas? What are some exercises can they do? And if there's any resources out there that people can find?
Yeah, so mainly what I'm going to encourage them to do is take the joint through its full range of motion that it allows at that time, right? The thing that I often say to patients or athletes are, we want to take it to the edge of the pain and then come back. And then we're going to start milking it in that range, knowing that as we push the edge, that edge is going to get further and further away, right? So we're creating mobility with repeated movements or repeated exercise into that position. There's some really good resources on YouTube. Kelly Starrett is really big in the CrossFit community. He does a lot of videos on staying mobile. That's kind of his claim to fame. He had a book called The Supple Leopard that's basically takes you through a bunch of different self-mobilizations that you can do to improve your overall mobility. So that's one of the ones that I will typically give to athletes, that resource, or to patients. MedBridge has a lot of good mobility exercises on their, you know, platform that they use through their website. So that's another kind of area, if you have access to it, you can use that to kind of generate some ideas.
So new grad, PT, ATC, all of us have gone through joint mobilization, and then not so much into the joint manipulation.
Right.
I test your research brain there. Is there a benefit of mobilizations, and does the manipulation outweigh it? And if it is outweighing it, what are the resources, what are the continued education that if somebody were interested in wanting to go into a higher level of manual care that they can look into?
Right. So, you know, the research is kind of spotty. I think you can make the research say whatever you want it to say when it comes to, you know, mobilizations versus manipulation. From what I've seen in the research, it's typically there's no additional benefit to doing a mobilization over a manipulation, but there is a benefit of doing – there are some articles that say that there is a benefit of doing a manipulation over a mobilization. So if you're going to hedge your bets, probably a manipulation is going to be a little bit more effective, and usually the outcomes happen a little bit quicker, right? So if someone's looking to, you know, gain that additional knowledge to feel comfortable with performing those manipulations, oftentimes there's going to be some CCU or CEU courses that you can take. Typically, they're going to be, you know, an upper quarter course versus a lower quarter course. There's also, you know, certified orthopedic manual therapy courses that they can take that are a little bit more intensive and make you feel a little bit more confident in your skills. And then you can take that a step further, which is what I did coming out of school, and pursue a fellowship in manual therapy, which is where you get kind of immersed in what manual therapy is, and then you get exposed to many different techniques and when to use them. So that's always an option as well, although it's a little bit more pricey of an option, to be honest.
Do you feel like manual therapy alone can do the trick, or do you feel like there's still some benefit to good old-fashioned, you know, exercise and things like that?
Yeah. So I used to think, oh, manual therapy is going to, you know, solve the world and, you know, solve all our problems. But with experience, I've kind of learned that manual therapy is just another tool for your toolbox. And every patient cannot just be treated with one tool. So you have to analyze the patient, see what's going to benefit them the most. In general, most of the research is going to say manual therapy plus exercise or plus another modality is going to have greater benefits than that exercise regimen alone or even that manual therapy alone. So oftentimes you have to pair it with something else for the benefit of the patient and to get those improved outcomes.
Is it a lower threshold of muscle activation? Is it a certain energy system? What type of exercise is best teamed up with?
Yeah, so good question. So oftentimes the way I'll structure it is I'm going to perform my manual therapy at the beginning to create more movement through that range of the joint, and then I'm going to follow it up with some exercise that is first to generate or, you know, facilitate that mobility that I just gave them. And that's also kind of for their education on what they can do at home. Then I'm going to go into exercises that provide this facilitation of the muscles that I think are inhibited and causing some of those issues, right? So that neuromuscular reeducation piece is going to be super important early on. And then after we do the kind of neuromuscular warm-up, if you want to call it that, then we get into the true kind of strengthening of those muscles. So there's a nice little paradigm that you can kind of follow to create mobility or generate mobility, right, through manual therapy and then focused exercises. And then you want to warm up the muscles, so that neuromuscular reeducation, and then get into strength, power, and, you know, everything else that you're trying to accomplish with the athlete or patient.
So I have more questions for you, but unfortunately we're closing in our time. If somebody else has some more questions for you, what's the best way they can contact you?
Yeah, so probably the easiest way to contact me is through my Memorial Hermann email. That is dexter.upton@memorialhermann.org. Also, they can always stop by the Bel Air Clinic. It's at the corner of 59 and 610. We're located right next to the Memorial Hermann Orthopedic and Spine Hospital in the UT Physicians Building. I'm always happy to talk about anything and everything. So if y'all want to stop by or shoot me an email, I'd be happy to respond.
All right. Thanks, Dexter.
Mm-hmm.